Philip Goff, thanks for joining us. How are you?
Hello, Stephen. I'm very well. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure entirely. I was just looking over some of your writing before when it was announced that you was coming on the show, and I think we're gonna have a cracking conversation, actually, given where we're both coming from. Maybe you could just let our listeners and audience know what it is you do. What keeps you busy?
I'm a philosopher at Durham University in the cold north of England, and I spend most of my time trying to work out the ultimate nature of reality. I'm particularly interested in consciousness. Perhaps the biggest challenge of contemporary science and philosophy is how the brain manages to produce this inner world of colors and sounds and smells and tastes that we all enjoy. And I've defended the odd-sounding view that the best explanation of this is panpsychism, that consciousness goes all the way down to the fundamental building blocks of reality, which sounds a bit odd, but has been taken much more seriously in recent years.
All right. Do I detect a slight Merseyside twang?
I am well spotted. I am a Liverpudlian. People from Liverpool can never spot it, but I am a Liverpudlian.
I'm in Manchester. Alarms go off straight away when there's a scouse in the vicinity.
We can be friends, I hope, for this.
I hope so. I like to transcend tribal rivalries myself. But especially,
I like Manchester.
Yeah, well, especially since I'm looking forward to getting into this, because these are the big topics, aren't they? Like, fundamental to the meaning of life, really. So, like you say, consciousness, that's the spooky one, isn't it? That's the mysterious one. You know, I suppose the debate really would tip, you know, usually at its most polarized would be between people who would say, you know, consciousness is sort of just a product of the brain and it ceases to exist at death when the brain is, you know, completely destroyed. People, usually monotheist religious types, would say actually our consciousness is something that exists external to that and perhaps will live on in some form or way. Where do you come down on this debate?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that dichotomy between, you know, do you believe in the God of traditional religion or are you a secular atheist? You know, many people, at least in the West, think they have to fit into one team or the other. It's like, whose side are you on, Richard Dawkins or the Pope? You know what I mean? And you know, I was raised Catholic as a good Liverpudlian, but decided I was an atheist when I was 14 and refused to get confirmed, upset my grandmother. And I guess I was quite happily on team secular atheist for a long time. But just recently, over maybe the last 5 or 6 years, I've come to think that actually both of these worldviews are inadequate. Both of them have things they can't explain about reality. And hence, you know, what I've explored in my most recent book, modestly titled Why the Purpose of the Universe, is whether actually there are neglected middle ground options between these two polarized extremes. And that's what I've got really interested in exploring recently.
I suppose then if you were going to be like a Dawkinsian cynic on this, you would say that this is a case of basically religious spirituality without any of the annoying dietary requirements or church attendance, things like that. So where are you coming down from on this, where you could really kind of square it with something that perhaps was scientific, if that is indeed the path you take?
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing I like about Richard Dawkins is, you know, he aims at not the view we'd like to be true, but the view that's most likely to be true. I think there's things traditional religion struggles to explain, such as the suffering we find in the universe. But I think there's actually also things our traditional atheist view of a meaningless, purposeless universe struggles to explain as well, particularly the so-called fine-tuning of physics for life. This is the recent discovery of the last few decades that for life to be possible, certain numbers in physics had to be just right. So, you know, perhaps the example that's most baffled cosmologists revolves around dark energy. This is the force that propels the accelerating expansion of the universe. In 1998, we discovered our universe is not only expanding, but it's accelerating. And when scientists calculated that number, sometimes called the cosmological constant, the force of dark energy that's pushing things apart, they discovered a surprising fact, right? If that number had been a little bit stronger, everything would have shot apart so quickly that no two particles would have ever met. We wouldn't have had stars or planets or any kind of structural complexity whatsoever. Whereas, if that number had been a little bit weaker, it wouldn't have counteracted gravity, which meant that everything would have collapsed back on itself in the first split second after the Big Bang. And therefore, for life or anything interesting to be possible, that number had to be like Goldilocks porridge, just right. And I think, like many scientists and philosophers increasingly, it's just radically improbable that that number would be just right for life just by some kind of cosmic fluke. So I really think this is something our contemporary idea of a meaningless, purposeless universe struggles to accommodate, because it looks like some kind of directedness towards life at the fundamental level at the very early stages of the universe.
That's a great answer. And I suppose, I mean, I'll get back onto this idea of, you know, meaning in life and the universe, because this is what motivates us all. And I found as I've got a lot older, that questions become a bit more of a difficult one. And I find myself being less hostile towards spirituality and religion in a way that I once was, I suppose. But in regard to this, like, fine-tuning observation, which is undoubtedly true, the conditions that we are the beneficiaries of, we're here. And with you saying that's improbable, I mean, to me, I suppose what I would say is that if the universe is as vast as we believe it is, you know, perhaps even infinite, surely that these conditions could arise by chance at least once, given the, you know, the variables.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Just on your first point, I think it is such a huge demographic now, the people who class themselves as spiritual but not religious, who don't quite feel satisfied by the sort of new atheist Richard Dawkins idea, but are sort of in some way alienated by traditional religion. So it's a big proportion of the population, but I find academics standardly don't cater for those people. And so we get this idea that it's like fluffy thinking. But I think that's just because people haven't put in the work to develop, you know, scientifically, philosophically rigorous frameworks for making sense of this. And I think it's really exciting that this is what's starting to happen now. And this is one of the things I'm trying to do in this book, bringing together that very rigorous work that's been done by academics on making sense of the sort of spiritual but not religious. But coming straight to your question, yeah, so many science, this is not controversial fringe physics, right? This is, as you say, pretty broadly understood in physics now, that for life to be possible, these numbers had to be just right. Now, many scientists and philosophers who think this needs explaining go for the multiverse hypothesis. So you said then, oh, well, the universe is so big, won't these numbers vary? Well, not quite, because at least in our current understanding of physics, these are numbers that have applied from the Big Bang onwards and apply to all of the observable universe that we've been part of, this expanding universe. So if all there is our universe, the universe we've observed, then these numbers, as far as we understand, have been constant throughout the whole of that universe. But what if there are other universes? That's the question. Many scientists and philosophers, in struggling to explain this, theorize maybe there are many universes, maybe infinite number of universes, all with slightly different numbers in their physics. So in some, gravity is stronger, in some it's weaker, in some the universe expands quicker, in some it's slower. So if you've got enough universes with enough variety in their physics, maybe statistically speaking, you're going to get one that's just by chance, just right for life. Now, to be honest, that's what I used to believe in. I've always thought this needed explaining, but I thought the multiverse hypothesis looked like, you know, the most plausible explanation, better than some strange idea of a directedness towards life. But it was only when I looked deeply into this, I discovered actually some really crucial work by philosophers of probability that have discovered that actually there's just some dodgy reasoning in the multiverse hypothesis. And I was kind of dragged kicking and screaming into thinking, actually, there's no other alternative. We need to take seriously this idea, strange as it seems that there is directedness towards life at the fundamental level of reality. That feels weird. You know, that feels odd to me. But I think, you know, we need to set aside both our religious biases, but also our secular biases. If that's where the evidence is pointing, then, you know, we should, who are we to say? We just need to follow the evidence where it leads. Should I tell you about why the multiverse is this dodgy reasoning?
Yeah, I mean, just listening to that, I often think that to kind of invoke multiple universes kind of contradicts an Occam's razor approach to a question anyway. But yeah, go ahead. This is fascinating.
Yeah, so it's obviously a technical debate and you try and simplify it. But there's a nice analogy that gets the basic idea. So the charge is that the multiverse person commits what's called the inverse gambler's fallacy. People might have heard of the gambler's fallacy, actually. This is, suppose you've been playing, I don't know, roulette all night and you've had really bad luck. You've had crap rolls all night and you think, I'm going to have one more go. I'm bound to have good luck this time because I've had bad luck all night. Now, everyone agrees that's a fallacy. A fallacy, by the way, is a mistake in reasoning. Because no matter how much you've been playing, you know, rolling two dice to get a double six, it doesn't matter if this is your first roll or you've been playing all night, the odds of getting a double six are the same, one in 36. You know, that's just well understood probability theory. Right, the inverse gambler's fallacy goes like this, right? So suppose, Stephen, you and I go into a casino tonight, maybe in Manchester, and the first room we go into, there's someone just having an incredible run of luck. They're just winning game after game after game, winning millions of pounds. They're just doing incredibly well. And I say to you, wow, there must be a lot of people in the casino tonight. And you say, Philip, what are you talking about? We've just seen this one guy. What's that got to do with people elsewhere in the casino? And I say, well, if there's just one person playing in the casino tonight, then it's really improbable that someone's going to have a good run of luck. But if there are thousands of people playing in the casino, then it's not so surprising that someone in the casino, somebody's going to have a good run of luck. Now, everyone agrees also that is a fallacy. That is a mistake in reasoning because our evidence that we've observed is just this one person playing well, right? No matter how many people there are in the casino, it has no bearing on how likely it is that this one guy is going to have a run of luck. But that just seems exactly the same reasoning of the person trying to explain this weird fine-tuning in terms of the multiverse. They look at our universe and they say, oh my God, it's got the right numbers for life. There must be loads of other universes with the wrong numbers. But that's the same error. All we've observed is this one universe. No matter how many other unobservable universes there are out there, it has no bearing on how likely it is that our universe will have the right numbers for life. So I'm sorry, it's a little bit complicated, but I hope that analogy gets it across. And, you know, so this is what over a long period of time made me just take these very strange ideas seriously. And, you know, I really do think that's where the evidence is pointing towards what I call cosmic purpose, some kind of directedness towards life at the fundamental level of reality, strange as that sounds.
Yeah, and I think interpretations and conversations and studies into this are always really valuable because there's nothing that stems from what you're doing or saying which logically leads to you dictating, you know, what food people can eat or, you know, whether they should be masturbating, for instance, you know, the kind of kooky kind of proclamations you get from monotheism. This idea of meaning really fascinates me, though, and like I say, it's something that has resonated more with me as I've got older. And I've always kind of, my line in the sand, I suppose, is with spirituality. I would say I'm a spiritual person in many ways. For instance, I mean, I've stood at the edge of the Grand Canyon and had a certain feeling that can probably only be described as spiritual. You know, I'm in love. I have a long-term partner. I have family members I love. You know, all this wealth of experience, you know, music, art, literature, all these things provide some kind of meaning and give me experiences which I perhaps term spiritual. But I suppose where I draw the line is kind of saying, well, none of that really ever trips over into the realm of supernatural. So I suppose what I'm asking in a really long-winded way is, is what you believe about the universe, is this something that would just be explained as natural phenomena if we did have a full understanding of it? Mm. Or are you invoking some sort of supernatural entity to explain our current situation?
That's a great question, Stephen. And yeah, I feel those solid secular intuitions, in as much as I don't want to go for something dogmatic where this is what you've got to believe, you know, come what may, whatever the evidence suggests. I'm somebody who naturally wants to be open-minded. But that goes both ways, as I say. I think in some ways, the situation with fine-tuning now is a little bit like in the 17th century, where we first started getting evidence that we weren't in the center of the universe. And people struggled to accept that because it didn't fit with the picture of reality they'd got used to. And now we tend to mock our ancestors in the 16th century, I should say. Say, oh, well, those stupid religious people, why didn't they just follow the evidence? But I think every generation absorbs a worldview they can't see beyond. And I think at the moment, that dogmatic worldview is this idea that we're living in this meaningless, purposeless universe, that that's definitely the truth, whatever the evidence suggests. And I think future historians looking back will think, how bizarre that people in the 21st century ignored this fine tuning just because it didn't fit with the picture of the world they got used to. But yeah, I mean, I think that's where many people are. A sense of spirituality, a sense of something deeper, a sense of the meaning and profundity of life perhaps goes beyond what your kind of Richard Dawkins picture suggests, and are struggling to ways to make sense of that. So, you know, most of my book is just a cold-blooded scientific philosophical argument for what I call cosmic purpose. But the first and last chapters are thinking about the implications for human meaning and purpose, connecting to spiritual practice, to community, even to political struggle, that broader understanding of the human condition. And taking seriously these big questions. I guess people will disagree with it, but just engaging with these big, important questions, I think, is so important.
It's fascinating. And the only way you can really prevent, I suppose, your beliefs in this regard or intuitions from coming dogmas is to have them challenged and have them collide with other ideas. So with that being said, if anyone's got any questions for Philip, put them in the comments now and I'll get them to him. But just to switch gears a little bit, I think I've spent most of my time here kind of pushing back on the idea of perhaps a creator or something supernatural. But why is it that you reject the idea of God? I mean, obviously it'd wrap things up nicely. That even the concept of fine tuning in of itself, could imply some intelligent design, you know, the prime mover, the uncaused cause. Wouldn't it wrap this up all nicely just to invoke some sort of omnipotent being?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think God is one explanation of fine tuning. Maybe God's fixed the numbers right for life. I don't think it's a very good explanation, though, for the familiar reason, what's called the problem of evil and suffering, this challenge of reconciling a loving, all-powerful God with the terrible suffering we find in the world. You know, why would a loving God create the North American long-tailed shrew that paralyzes its prey and then eats it alive over several weeks before it dies from its wounds? You know, it's just, that makes no sense. Like, why would you? So I don't think God's a great explanation. What's the alternative, actually? And I didn't quite answer your question. Do I go for something supernatural? Well, I actually explore a range of hypotheses. One possibility is just tweaking the characteristics of God a bit. You know, maybe it's a bad God. Maybe it's an amoral God. Maybe it's a God of limited abilities who's just made the best universe they can. Or maybe the simulation hypothesis developed by the philosopher Nick Bostrom, that we live in a computer simulation and our creator is just some random software engineer in the next universe up. So that's one possibility, a little bit in the supernatural realm, I guess. Another option, though, the philosopher Thomas Nagel developed this idea of teleological laws of nature, just laws of nature with purposes built into them. So maybe we don't need a conscious mind to undergird cosmic purpose. Maybe there's just a natural tendency of the universe towards life, one that interacts with the traditional laws of physics in ways we don't yet understand. But the third, my favorite hypothesis in the book is what's called cosmopsychism, the idea that the universe itself is a conscious mind directed towards certain goals. And I try to argue this isn't quite as extravagant as a hypothesis as you might first think. And it has the advantage of not going for something supernatural. Why postulate some supernatural being outside the universe if you can make sense of the universe itself being some kind of conscious entity that fine-tuned itself? And I think that's actually something that makes kind of rigorous scientific and philosophical sense.
It's a good answer. So I'm just going to put a question to you, which is kind of tangentially related to consciousness, another big one in that sphere. Where do you stand on determinism versus free will?
Good, right. So I mean, it's a huge question and something I go into in the book. I'm somewhat agnostic. I think the reality of free will is not as certain as the reality of consciousness. It could turn out that it's actually an illusion, that we're not really free in the way we think we are. I think that's much harder to make sense of with our own feelings and experiences. However, I think that the scientific and the philosophical arguments against free will, for example, in the popular sphere put out by Sam Harris, are just terrible arguments. I don't think that there's really any good. I think it's actually a sort of a dogma. I think there's this sense that everything that happens in the brain must be explicable in terms of the basic equations of physics, and therefore we're not really free. I don't think we know enough about the brain to know that one way or the other. I think that's more of a sort of zeitgeist that people feel, like it fits with the feeling of the moment. Just like in the 16th century, you know, we couldn't accept we weren't in the center of the universe because it didn't fit with our worldview. So yeah, I mean, I do tentatively believe in free will because I think it's currently an open question, and it seems that we have free will, and that's some evidence for it, if only tentative. And yeah, but we should of course have an open mind on these questions.
I think it's a particularly terrifying subject because I think we all intuitively at least believe we are, you know, in possession of free will. We are the masters of our own destiny. We are in charge of the choices we make. And the idea that we're perhaps not is kind of scary in a lot of ways. You know, maybe the idea that we're just carrying out impulses directed to us by our biological functions in an unconscious way kind of throws into question, you know, many things, including our entire justice system. I think that's one of the things Sam Harris touched on as well. So like you, I'm completely agnostic on that, but then again, I don't believe I have any choice to be. Just thought I'd steal a very poor dad free will joke there for you. But I suppose keeping on the vein of Sam Harris, Philip, have you tried meditation?
Absolutely. Well, I used to meditate every morning before my second child arrived, and now it's a little bit impossible. If I happen to wake up earlier than the kids. But yeah, I do in the final chapter have a kind of theory of what spiritual advancement might be thought to consist in, relating it to meditation and the use of psychedelics and so on. This is an extract that was printed in the Wall Street Journal. It's a British audience, isn't it? So it's probably irrelevant. But yeah, I have this idea, well, how to not get into too much of the details, but that spiritual advancement is kind of about undoing our conditioned ways of seeing reality. I think, you know, we tend to think we're just seeing the world as we look around us as it really is. But there's all sorts of ways in which we subtly project onto the world our culturally specific conception of it, as though that were how reality really is. And I think things like meditation, psychedelics, great art can undo that. Just to say about art, how art might do that. You know, I think I contrast sort of two extremes of bad art. One extreme, you've got just very boring bad art that just follows the standard cultural rules without doing anything interesting. The other extreme, you've got sort of anarchic. Well, I love punk. I love the original punk bands, you know, that just tear up the rules, say, you know, screw everything. And that's great in a way, but the problem is it's not sustainable. It quickly becomes another fashion, another culturally conditioned way of seeing the world. You know, I'm a punk and I dress like this. So great art for me works within our contingent cultural frameworks, but undoes them subtly from within. Maybe like the fellow Liverpoolians, the Beatles did. You know, they started off with standard rock and roll and they sort of did new things with it that no one had imagined before. So I think meditation and art and, of course, psychedelics kind of wrenches away those cultural conditioned ways of seeing the world in sometimes quite scary ways. But yeah, I think these are all very important parts of, we want to make rigorous sense of this idea of being spiritual but not religious in the ways Sam Harris has tried to do, for example, and his partner Annika Harris, who I've had lots of interaction with and kind of done some work with. I think it's all very exciting times.
Yeah, I mean, I've got no idea either way, but I'm always fascinated to read someone's perspective. I seem to remember him and Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, that is, and Daniel Dennett going back and forth on this question of free will for the longest time. And I think I read every word and I was still none the wiser when I came to the end of it. But which I suppose brings on, I mean, this might just be an issue of one here, but I mean, is there an argument here that, you know, evolved primates as we are with our ape brains, that, you know, pondering the meaning of life and trying to fit in, you know, the size of the universe, we're just not equipped for it on a physical level. I mean, we seem to be we are the only species that sits around pondering the meaning of life, I'm sure. I mean, is this an adaptation? I mean, what is the point of this? How does this serve us in any way?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a possibility that we should take seriously. There's no reason to think if creatures that have evolved for survival are going to be able to uncover all of the secrets of the universe. Although, on the other hand, it's pretty spectacular that we've done so well. You know, we've traced back the universe 13 billion years to its origins. It's just quite extraordinary. But that might be a possibility. But I see no reason to accept defeat just yet. I think this fine-tuning thing is weird, doesn't fit with our current worldview. But as I try to show in the book, I think there are coherent possibilities for explaining it. And I think the reason we're not taking them seriously is not because they don't fit the evidence or they're incoherent. It's just because for cultural reasons, they don't fit with how we've got used to thinking about reality. So I guess that's what I'm trying to persuade people to do, to not be so dogmatic, just as I think many secular atheists are critical of religious people for being dogmatic, but I want them to sort of think, well, maybe there's a bit of dogmatism in being skeptical of where this fine-tuning seems to be pointing towards.
Yeah, I mean, keeping an open mind rather is paramount, is it? But I suppose, I think I've not really asked the question. I mean, obviously, if we were to accept the premise that secular atheism doesn't provide meaning or is kind of antithetical to the idea of meaning, how could what you propose provide meaning in that sense, this kind of in-between way of thinking? How does this provide meaning in a way that secular atheism seems incapable of?
Yeah, I mean, as I say, most of the book is just a cold-blooded argument for cosmic purposes, I call it, whether it's true or not. And look, I don't want to say secular atheists can't have a meaningful life. I don't go for the extreme view that if there's no purpose to the universe, it's all pointless. You know, we might as well kill ourselves. The Christian philosopher William Lane Craig argues for that. He says, we might as well kill each other. Also, the antinatalist atheist, my mind's gone blank, who thinks it's immoral to have kids because the universe is so pointless. But at the other extreme, the secular atheist might say, there probably isn't cosmic purpose, but even if there is, it would be irrelevant to the meaning of our lives. I think that's too far the other way. I think we can have meaningful lives without cosmic purpose through kindness, creativity, the pursuit of knowledge. But if there is a purpose to the universe, if we can take that idea seriously, I think there's a potential perhaps for more meaning in our lives. If we want our lives to make a difference, if you can contribute in some small way to the purpose of the whole of reality, that's bloody huge, right? And this that would be as big a difference as you can imagine making. So I try to sketch out how we can potentially have a more meaningful life by engaging with this idea, and how I've found in my own life a greater sense of peace and purpose from engaging with this perspective.
That's a great answer. And I might be a little bit unfair just to throw this at you in the 2 minutes we've got, but I'm kind of wondering, what do you think might get closer to the answers there? I mean, in terms of the universe and fine-tuning and meaning, I mean, will it be philosophy? Will it be a technological advancement? Because a lot of people, perhaps maybe unfairly, will look at the field of philosophy and say it's not really generating any new ideas. It's keeping good, older ideas alive, perhaps in some way. I spoke to somebody last week who said, you know, philosophy's not really improved on anything the Greeks did, modern philosophy, that is, which perhaps a bit harsh. Maybe get your opinion on that.
Well, we are living in a time when society doesn't really understand what the hell the point of philosophy is and what the point of it is. And I think that's very unfortunate, because you cannot not do philosophy. The more you get to sort of foundational theoretical questions in physics, you bounce up against these theoretical questions. And if you say, oh, I don't believe in philosophy, what happens is you just get people doing bad philosophy. Stephen Hawking, in one of his books, famously started off saying, philosophy is dead, da da da, and then later in the book starts doing very bad philosophy about free will and so on. Because, you know, not because he's an idiot, but he hasn't read the literature, exposed his views to peer review. But one thing I've done in my last book, Galileo's Error, was trace back the problem of consciousness to the foundations of the scientific revolution, the philosophical foundations, the philosophy designed by Galileo, the father of modern science. And I try to show that the problem of consciousness is baked into these in underlying philosophical assumptions of science. And if we want to solve it, we need to have to readdress that. So there's always philosophy, there's always worldview in the background, and you need to engage with it or you'll just be doing it badly.
Philip, you did beautifully there, summarizing that in the mean amount of time I gave you. Thank you for that. A full-throated defense of philosophy there. That has me convinced for sure. So maybe you could let people know where they can find more of your writing and your book.
Oh, website. Well, the book's called Why the Purpose of the Universe. I hope it's accessible to a general audience. It's quite cheap. There's an audio version and everything. philipgoffphilosophy.com. I've got lots of videos and interviews with Joe Rogan and other people. I'd spend a lot of time arguing on Twitter. Philip_Goff, Philip with one L. YouTube channel, Mind Chat, where I do with a philosopher with the polar opposite opinion to me on consciousness. I think it's everywhere. He thinks it doesn't exist. And we interview we interview scientists and philosophers. We try to model constructive disagreement. So, spend too much time on Twitter, but that's about it. Oh, my last book, Galileo's Error, is more on the problem of consciousness and panpsychism. The new book, Why the Purpose of the Universe, is more on that as well, but also on this question of, is taking seriously the idea that there might be a purpose to the universe.
Philip, this has flown by. It's been absolutely fascinating, and I'll be checking out your book, of course. So thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Stephen. Lovely chatting. See you again.
See you again. Take care.